This is the Kratom Science Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Gallagher, blog and social media writer for KratomScience.com, your source for all things Kratom.
My guest is Dr. Zach Walsh. He is a cannabis expert and psychology professor at University of British Columbia and the third Canadian guest on the Kratom Science Podcast. Yeah, I've been watching a lot of your talks about cannabis, and you're a professor at University of Columbia,
British Columbia, yeah. And what is your podcast?
It's called the Kratom Science Podcast.
Okay.
Yeah, but I don't mind mostly talking about cannabis because I've talked about Kratom for about 50-something episodes. Most of the people who listen, I think, will be interested in cannabis and psychedelics as well. Cannabis has been legalized, and Canada was one of the first countries to fully legalize cannabis. Has there been, and that was in 2018, 2 years ago, has there been an impact on the research that you can do in Canada because of legalization?
You know, yes and no. So the big moment for us with legalization and research really was when through a series of court victories, they revised the medical cannabis program to allow for what were called licensed producers. So it used to be that you could only get your medical your cannabis from a single producer that was hired by the government, and they did a fairly, they had a limited range of cannabis products that were not widely accepted by medical cannabis patients. And that's why why the dispensaries cropped up, because yes, there was a program and yes, it was legal, but the government product was not satisfactory to most patients. And so they were allowed to grow their own, et cetera. But it was revised to say, okay, we're going to have a competitive model where there's going to be for-profit companies that are producing cannabis. And when that came on board, all of a sudden there was product that we could use that was for research purposes, so we could do research with good quality cannabis. Mm-hmm. And there was an industry that was supportive of that research. And that was a couple years before broad legalization. I think it was maybe 3 years before we legalized entirely that amendment was made. And that's really what opened up the research for us, because all of a sudden there was companies that could be partnered with, they could provide cannabis. And that was in a way a bigger change than legalization itself. If anything, legalization in some ways makes medical research more difficult, just because if you're trying to do trials or what have you, everyone has access to cannabis anyhow, and it makes it paradoxically, people are not particularly interested in being part of all the rigmarole of a clinical trial mm-hmm. when you can just get the medicine, quite easily at a corner store.
Yeah. And you had mentioned in one of your talks, I was watching a couple of the talks on YouTube, that here in the United States, we have legal cannabis that's allowed to be used in clinical trials that's grown by the NIDA in Mississippi. And you mentioned that it's grown, you said it was grown with disdain, which is pretty funny because it's so low quality and it, you know, includes stems and seeds. And it sounds like the stuff I used to get in high school.
I can't speak to the mental state of the growers, and I'm sure they're very talented. I know that they're limited in what they're allowed to produce. So I've said that, and I wince a bit about it being held accountable. It appears as if it was grown with disdain. Okay. One could be forgiven for assuming that based on the end product. But I certainly don't want to infer that the people who are working hard in the Mississippi farm, where I believe it's produced still, have disdain for it. I think that they're probably quite into their work and doing as good a job as they're able to do, given the restrictions. But there is a study. It's not just me. There's that study from a team of Cinnamon Bidwell from University of Colorado and other places that looked at that cannabis, that NIDA cannabis, and compared it to what's in dispensaries. And even from a chemical analysis, it has a different cannabinoid profile, largely because it's so old. So it has a different, it's not like what people are using medically. So it hurts the validity of the research. That was our position in Canada for a long time too, until the licensed producers came along. Now we can get decent weed for research.
You talked a bit in your TEDx talk about the history of cannabis going back millennia. What do we know about why people started to first use cannabis?
It's interesting. I mean, I think the short and cheeky answer to that is because it works. I mean, it has a profound, undeniable effect, which also, I think feeds into some of the difficulties with research. Everybody wants placebo-controlled research, but when everyone's tried cannabis, people tend to know if they're in the placebo condition, and it does have such an overt effect. So, it's always a wonder how humans first assayed these different products, whether it's kratom or whether it's cannabis. But we know that the history of it is from Central Asia, from China, and it goes all the way back into sort of a mix of I suppose that time in our history when medicine and religion and science were less separate. So the Sheng Nun is the historical figure in the Chinese literature who is also attributed to discovering tea. And if you look at pictures of him, he doesn't look entirely human. So it's sort of a shamanic healer historical figure that is thought to have introduced cannabis. But whether to the extent that he was an actual figure or a composite of a bunch of different folks, or just sort of a conduit of healing traditions, I think it's really there's probably some anthropologists or historians who'd have better things to say about that than me. But I think the take home is that it goes back to prehistory, it's a long history, a synergistic history. We know that cannabis pops up. It's sometimes called the trail follower, so it pops up where humans have disturbed the ground in camps. So it's a real synergy. I sometimes like to make the analogy, it's like a dog. There's so many different varieties. And I think kratom is like that in a way as well, as it's sort of, and I don't know the history of kratom as well. And I don't know if it's been as, comprehensively documented, at least in the English literature. I'm sure there's probably some really great stuff out there for someone who can dig it up. But a lot of the plants really have emerged in partnership with humans, and humans help them to spread and they help humans. So it's sort of a synergistic relationship.
And along with that, we've recently have some fear of cannabis and prohibition. And I mean, we can trace it in American history and recent history back to the 30s with Harry Anslinger and everything. Is there any evidence that there was this kind of reaction to cannabis or any substances like prior to the 19th century?
Substances that change are psychoactive, that change our consciousness, have always been so highly prized by different societies. And I think they become emblematic of the societies that use them. Certainly you can see how alcohol has been integrated into Judeo-Christian traditions. And, despite the public health consequences of alcohol use, it's really enshrined, and you really wouldn't want to try to get rid of it. It's just part of the culture, and it's the same with other substances. And then when cultures clash, they often demonize each other's substances. So even there was a time when you could be put to death in Germany for coffee because it was thought to be an infidel's beverage. So I do take some, when I look at the long history of drug prohibition, it's not just us have had these crazy ideas about trying to villainize substances and the people who use them, and picked some that for seemingly random reasons, if you look at how dangerous they actually are or aren't, and picked some and said they're great and others and said they're evil and people who use them are should be punished, etc. It's not a unique thing, although it does seem to be like many other terrible things, it's been perfected in the modern era.
I mean, with kratom, that's kind of what people are dealing with. It seems to be to work for most people and be relatively safe. And the study you did with Dr. Swager and the folks that run Arrowhead show that most people in self-reporting anyway say that it's been a positive with a few side effects. And then we see a lot of case studies that are just, you know, single cases of people developing maybe an addiction to kratom, maybe mixed it with something else and got sick, or call it a kratom related death. If I mean, one guy got shot and they called that a kratom related death. So some of these are clearly they're trying to accentuate the negatives. So what accounts for that?
Well, it's almost a case study in drug hysteria, isn't it? I mean, yeah. I think that was one of the things that really interested me about kratom right off the bat, is it's kind of obscure to most people. So it's almost like an inkblot test or something, like how people how different agencies and different organizations respond to kratom says a lot about how they respond to drugs more broadly, because they probably don't know much about kratom. So there's certainly a group of people where there's this almost knee-jerk enthusiasm for finding a problem with kratom and really exaggerating it based on, I really don't know what, other than some kind of a drug hysteria. It's hard to say why, you know, it's quite, my sense of it is that, like anything, it's not entirely benign. It can cause, certainly it can cause a bit of a dependence. But in terms of the acute risks of it, I mean, we tolerate so many dangerous things in our society. I live in the mountains of British Columbia here, and there's people skiing all the time. And I see students come in with broken legs, and you go to the hills and you see people carried away on stretchers. And yet we don't seem to have any problem with the fact that people enjoy skiing, or it does something for their health and well-being, and they're allowed to do it. And nobody would think to prohibit that. Yet I would suggest that skiing is every bit as dangerous as kratom.
Yeah. Yeah, really. I definitely would not ski, and I take kratom a couple days a week.
So. There you go. And no one's had to carry you out on a stretcher.
No, not yet.
You didn't miss your finals because you had a broken leg due to a kratom related accident. Quantify it. You know, we don't even quantify those risks. I mean, you could do case studies of people skiing.
Yeah.
Terrible.
This is one of your talks that was from last year, Psychology Colloquia. I think it was titled Cannabis Revised. And you mentioned an article about that Malcolm Gladwell wrote that about somebody that smoked pot and then went on a murderous rampage. And his source was a psychiatrist for that. Does the field of psychiatry in general have an embedded vendetta against substances like kratom and cannabis, maybe because it keeps them in business if people are afraid of them and want to get off and they go to see the psychiatrist?
Well, I know a lot of really great psychiatrists. A lot of people in mental health generally are there because they want to try to alleviate suffering. But at the same time, and I would say that's, you know, almost everybody, but there's a conservatism in the medical field. And also, you know, when it comes to psychiatry, they're really they're the gatekeepers of normal. So, you know, they have a quasi-religious status in our society of saying what's sane, what's okay, what's admissible. And so they're defensive of things that come from outside their purview. And that includes, you know, substances like maybe kratom and cannabis that come from other cultures and have ancient histories that are steeped in religion and other things, mysticism that are maybe incongruent with their training. So, you know, a new drug can come down the drug development pipe and it should be mysterious. It doesn't have thousands of years of anecdotal use, but because the medical establishment feels comfortable with this pathway, even though there's not much known about these drugs, they say, oh yes, this is something, this is promising, this is exciting, we should try it. And if people have bad results, they should stick with it until the good results show up, et cetera. But then something like kratom or cannabis comes along and they're like, wait, we don't know anything about this. There's not enough research. And it's really, I think, a little bit narrow in the definition of what constitutes evidence. And what constitutes truth. It really gets to sort of an epistemological issue of how do you know what you know. So if you only want to know about safety and effectiveness of substances of what can be found from a clinical trial, then that is all you know. And then you can say that there's nothing known about things like kratom and cannabis. But if you want to look at, you know, what have people been using for a very long time, and what do we know about these traditional uses, then there is a lot you can know, and maybe you know a lot more than you do about some of these pharmaceutical drugs, really. So it really comes down to what does it mean to know, and how quick some psychiatrists and medical establishments are to say there's not enough evidence, we don't know anything. And really what they're saying is we're keeping a gate on truth, and what's true is what we can say. And how do you enter the club of what's true? Well, it takes a lot of money because you have to do these RCTs, and that really limits what can even be tested. I don't, you know, something like kratom or cannabis, there's limited ability to put them through an RCT pathway. It's not one size fits all. So these have several constituents. They're not single molecule medicines. And they may have limited commercial potential that would, pay someone back for spending millions of dollars on that drug development pathway. So we can all, solemnly nod our heads and say, yes, we need more RCTs. But if we want to be pragmatic and say, hey, maybe these RCTs aren't going to happen, where are we left with? Do we just discard these medicines when they appear to have potential to treat things that are undertreated, when they appear to have potential to compete with other medicines that have really problematic side effects? I think these are sort of the questions that really guide my research and my science.
And by RCTs, you mean research clinical trials, is that right?
Yeah, sorry, I shouldn't use acronyms. Sorry about that. Randomized clinical trials. Yeah,
randomized. The kind of things that, okay.
Yeah.
There's a danger of kratom becoming illegal in this country, and which would, shut down research, which cannabis, they were researching cannabis before the prohibition, and it was like 80 years of epileptics, for example, that could have benefited directly from it. And what do we know about cannabis? Why do people use it today? What are they reporting?
Well, I mean, medically, the big reasons people use it, is pain, sleep, anxiety. Those are the big three that keep coming up again and again in all the surveys, really, is pain, sleep, and anxiety. And then there are different, subclusters of patients who use it for a variety of different reasons, from gastrointestinal issues to, nausea, the epilepsy, muscle spasms, et cetera. But those are more for specific conditions. I'd say if you look at pain, anxiety, and sleep, and even people who are using it for those other conditions will often report those as positive side benefits. I mean, managing pain is a big thing, and I think that's a big piece of kratom as well. And I'm interested to see how kratom and cannabis work together. Certainly anecdotally, we hear a lot of people having some good effects there, but it is tricky to do the research, just because kratom does remain sort of slightly obscure. It's hard to get good samples of kratom users. I know that Oliver Grundman and some other colleagues of mine are doing a great job of that, but
is there a difference between medicinal and recreational use for marijuana? My question is, isn't it all kind of medicinal if you're using it to kind of change your mental state?
So you're asking about the line between medical and recreational. I think that's such a good question. And it's certainly something that comes up with kratom too, right?
Yeah.
I think they're blurry boundaries. So there are some folks who use cannabis, let's say, for seizures or for other conditions, nausea, et cetera, where it's very effective and they may not even like the psychoactive effects. So it's a negative side effect. I wish I didn't feel this way, but it really, the payoff is worth it. And then there are other people who really don't, wouldn't describe themselves as having a medical reason. They just like to get high. And those two things are not the same, I don't think. And then it's even more complicated because those people who use it medically might sometimes use it just to get high. And then some people who use it primarily just because they like to, stick on the headphones and listen to some tunes while they're stoned, they may sometimes use it for a medical reason. So I don't think that there's, I don't think we can put, firm boundaries between those. I think that the analogy of a dog, I think is helpful in a way. I don't know. I like it. If we were to ban dogs, because they're a nuisance, they bite kids, protect the kids. That's always a big thing for drug prohibition. And, 90% of dog related accidents are due to kids. I don't know, but you could make a case of why, and I would never want to ban dogs, but you can make a case that they're a nuisance, but then you probably let them, if you were to revisit that, you might make exceptions for, people who are visually impaired. You might say, well, those people really need a dog, so let them have a dog. And then maybe there's people who are isolated and lonely and depression. That might be the next people you open it up to. And then eventually you'd say, well, everyone can have a dog because, how sad do you have to be to want to be cheered up by a dog? I think it goes, there's some cases where people really need the medicine and it might be purely medical. There's other cases where it's not medical at all. But for a lot of us, it's a mixture of being comforted by another species, plant species, and having a relationship with that plant that is beneficial.
Yeah, that's a good answer. And canine and cannabis, I don't know if they're related words, probably not. But
and kratom. Kratom.
Yeah. It's funny because everybody around the headquarters calls it Kratom, but they told me to call it Kratom because that's how most people pronounce it, which is, I don't know.
Well, I couldn't believe it when I found out that the second vowel was also controversial, because I was getting mixed up between Kratom and Kratom, and then someone said Kratom, and I was like, no, you can't mess with the O too. That means there's like many different options. What is the right way to pronounce it, man?
Dr. Singh from Malaysia. I interviewed him on here, and he said,
"Yes,
Brian, Singh, it's Kratom. Kratom.
Kratom.
It almost no R in there." Well, he said that's how it's pronounced in Malaysia anyway.
Off the tongue better than Kratom.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I gotta pick one.
While we're on semantics, you talked about the term marijuana. It has actual racial overtones, and a lot of people might react and say, well, that maybe that's just political correctness, but I think language is more important, isn't it? Because now a lot of people, we call it cannabis because we're acknowledging why it was outlawed in the past.
Political correctness is, really, I think, in the eye of the beholder. Yeah. Really, when someone accuses someone else of political correctness, they're saying, shut up.
Yeah.
What you're saying is not relevant.
Yeah.
And that's just, if that's what you mean, just say that. Don't accuse me of something odd, like political correctness, that I don't really know what it means. If someone wants to call something, they have a reason for it. The reason why, that argument when it comes to cannabis really doesn't hold much water, because the reason they switched it to marijuana in the first place is because of that reason. Because calling it something matters. Right. They tried to, everyone knew about cannabis as a medicine, mostly in tinctures, but it was an over-the-counter medicine. So if you're going to make some new drug scare around something, you can't just call it the thing that everybody already knows. You're not going to have like some ibuprofen mania. You've got to make something new. So they made it marijuana and tried to characterize it as coming from Mexico.
Yeah.
When really it's an Asian plant that was well known and came from China to India to Britain to the U.S. But no, they made it marijuana coming from Mexico and really did tie it to racism straight up. And I don't think there's much debate that the war on drugs is racist. There was a time when that was debatable, and I, like a lot of things, I'm glad to see that debate put to sleep. Yeah, it's racist, that's just one more reason why it's got to be stopped. It's always been racist. That's why we villainize some drugs, not others. And that's why kratom, as seemingly innocuous as it is in many ways, and has the potential, maybe if we learn more about it, to help us with this terrible opioid overdose epidemic that's a real, real, real threat. But yet it's being villainized because they can find, one case report from Sweden where someone mixed it with something dangerous and then had a bad outcome. But part of it is because it is this exotic drug. What is it? Ooh, we're scared of it. It's because it's exotic. if someone were to manufacture something like kratom, it would be considered a very promising pharmaceutical.
And it's crazy that they haven't yet. I mean, and it just seems like, you know, it's helping people more than it hurts. And it's not a clinical trial, but it's there's no reason these people are lying. Like, I know,
right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it gets into a pretty... There's sort of deep questions around what makes a medicine, what makes it effective. You know, one of the things that we find sometimes in the cannabis research is you'll ask someone, how is cannabis helping you? And they say, it's very helpful. Mm. You know, it really helps my symptoms. But if you track them over time, their symptoms don't get any better. So, I mean, I think one objection that people have to that research, and of course, is the kind of research that I do. So I think it does tell us a lot. But people say, oh, yeah, that people just think they're getting better. They're not getting better. And then you have to wonder, well, is thinking you're getting better a kind of a getting better? Like, what's the standard for what's helpful and what's effective? All these people, I don't think it's fair to dismiss all these anecdotal reports. You know, and in the absence of pronounced risk, which seems to be the case with kratom, we don't see terrible cases. They have to dig pretty hard to make these cases against it. If people seem to think that it's effective, then I think there should be a weight on that. I don't know why people are so concerned, like I say, about kratom when there's so many other dangerous things in the world. Why kratom?
You said in one of your talks that when studying psychedelics, you should consider a little bit of magic and a little bit of skepticism. Can you elaborate on that? Scientists need to consider a more kind of maybe spiritual perspective, or do spiritual people need to consider a more scientific perspective when it comes to psychedelics?
Well, I think I guess sort of what I'm saying there is I think that it doesn't. Just because you describe something in one way doesn't mean you've described it entirely. So we have to be open to the fact that we're not going to capture all the effects, whether it's in an RCT, randomized clinical trial, or whether it's in these cross-sectional designs, or whether it's in some of the more, you know, esoteric, fanciful descriptions of what people have. All of those give us a perspective on the experience that help us understand it in different ways. So yeah, I think it's important that we recognize that, you know, there was a time when I think there still are ways in which you know, contemporary Western medicine and magic and ritual are still entwined. And that maybe part of what we see with this interest in plant medicines like kratom, like psilocybin, like cannabis, beyond just whether or not they're more effective than a pharmaceutical. But, you know, I think there are people that, and many people who say there's something more appealing about those kind of approaches than pharmaceuticals. And, you know, there can be a tendency to write that off and say, oh, you know, just because something's natural doesn't mean it's safe. And what do you even mean by natural? And that's just a flaky idea. But I think we do a disservice to genuine longings of people for a different kind of approach to health and to wellness and to a connection with the way things might be that's a little bit different than our current medical paradigm. And it hasn't always been the way it is now. And it's going to change in the future too. So I think we want to stay open to what these plants bring us, not just try to shove them into the existing model of pharmaceuticals and say, look, kratom is as good as a pharmaceutical. Maybe in some ways it's better, in some ways it's worse, but I think we want to make space for that.
In psychedelic psychotherapy, it's something that's being explored again, it seems recently, after a big gap starting with the war on drugs. What does that look like? It seems to be some people are having making really good progress with their issues on psychedelics, and you know, this has come from in a culture that kind of demonize it as, you know, stories about people jumping out the window after they took a hit of acid and everything like that. And so what does that look like, a psychedelic psychotherapy session?
Well, you know, the typical model, and I don't think that there is a standard that has, you know, solidified yet, but I think there's definitely converging approaches. And what I think is consistent is, you know, a couple non-drug sessions of preparation and a couple non-drug sessions of integration. So you get ready for the experience, you focus yourself, et cetera. And then you sort of unpack it afterwards. In terms of what the actual session looks like, you know, it's sort of like a procedure in a sense that people will mostly be quiet, sleep mask, headphones with usually a pretty well-tailored soundtrack that's emotionally evocative, but not too distracting. So not a lot of lyrics or any lyrics usually. And the presence of a therapist, but the therapist is typically not that active, especially at high doses. It's not a place where you want to be doing a whole lot of talk therapy, other than to reassure someone and to let them go back and have their experience. There's time to talk about it in subsequent sessions. Mm-hmm. But really, if you were to see someone doing psychedelic psychotherapy, if things are going well, mostly just see someone lying on a couch with a sleep mask and maybe some headphones on and someone else standing, sitting by their side.
Yeah. Yeah. And no words. That explains, why the Grateful Dead was, a pretty good band, you know, 'cause they would jam out.
Grateful Dead is still my favorite band.
Yeah. And I saw you use Jerry Garcia in your one. I saw them twice. Under the Influence of Psychedelics, but
I
that was really quite
the Influence of Psychedelics. Yeah, something else, isn't it?
Yeah, that was really quite an experience. I mean, I don't know if there's anything that it's begun to explain what that was in science, but it was fun.
No,
it was fun anyway.
It was certainly fun. Yeah, you're making me miss live music for sure, and it doesn't get
any
better.
Oh, yeah. I know.
Good old Grateful Dead from my perspective.
There was a study called Reductions in Alcohol Use Following Medical Cannabis Initiation. How does that work? I know that, you know, I have problem drinking in the past, and then, you know, when I get sober, cannabis always, it helps. What it helps is I don't have to be in my annoying sober brain all day. I can have a little cannabis and get away from it with, and it helps with my intention to stay sober. Is that kind of the mechanism of how cannabis helps with alcohol cessation?
I love that question. That's one of the main areas of interest for me in research, is how does cannabis work as a substitute? Because I think, and it's going to be this, it's the same with kratom, is, you know, if we look at the real public health benefits, I think what we're going to have to do is we have to get a little bit more complicated and say, well, maybe the benefits aren't direct. Maybe they're indirect through reductions in the use of other substances. With kratom, obviously, it's opioids. Cannabis, it's opioids too, but also alcohol. Alcohol is the most consumed drug, and it's the most problematic. Even with the opioid overdose epidemic, I think the public health costs of alcohol are still greater. Mm-hmm. So if cannabis reduces alcohol use, then that's great. It could, and potentially it could increase it too, right? I mean, if you look at something like cocaine, it makes people drink more. So yeah. Not all drugs are substitutes. Some are complements where they make you drink more of them or use more of another drug. In the case of cannabis, I think there's a couple mechanisms of how cannabis reduces alcohol use. One can be the kind of thing you're talking about, where it's a direct mindful substitute, where you're like, I'm not going to drink alcohol, I'm going to use cannabis instead. And that maybe makes it more acceptable. It feels like less of a sacrifice if, you know, at the end of the day, you, instead of having a drink, you have a puff, and it does pretty much the same thing, gets you out of your head and creates sort of a buffer between one part of the day and another. I think that's probably a lot of it, is people mindfully, effortfully using cannabis as a substitute. I think it might also just directly have some, and one thing that we're interested in, this is something that hasn't come out yet, but one of my master's students just finished up a study looking at how about binge drinking, because really that's where the concern is with drinking, is mostly if people are drinking more than four or so drinks on an occasion, And once you get past five or six drinks, that's when you get into this danger zone where each additional drink increases risk of accident and negative outcomes. So even if you can cut someone's binge from seven beer to six beer, even though it seems like a small thing, at a public health level, it can be quite a savings. I think cannabis works there too. I think it causes people to drink a little more slowly. And maybe forget where they left their beer or that they even opened one.
That's great.
I'm joking, but really, that's one of the things that we found in our study was that cannabis combined with alcohol, people drank about a drink less in a binge, and that it might not have even been that intentional, that they may not have meant to. They just ended up drinking a little more slowly because they're smoking at the same time and ended up getting less drunk. And I mean, anecdotally, I've had that happen. You just drink more slowly.
Yeah. A lot of people I know get really sick if they do both. So they mostly ended up choosing, you know, the safer one. And there was another study you did on psychedelic use and intimate partner violence, and it shows that, like, this is in line with the public health issue, that it shows that it has a role, it regulates your emotions. Like, people who have used psychedelics are less likely to be violent.
It looks like it's partially that it leads to better, that it's associated with better emotion regulation. You know, I think that feeds into some of our ideas about how psychedelics might work. It just give you a little bit of a perspective on your emotion so that you can experience it as an emotion instead of being entirely fused with it. So it's just like a fact, like, I got to react to this. This is real. I'm being threatened, or I've had enough, or whatever. You have that little bit of distance on yourself where you can say, boy, I'm having that thought that I have had enough, and maybe I have, maybe I hadn't, but I don't need to act on it. I can just have that thought and keep on living my values, which are for most people to be nonviolent.
Yeah, and that's why I never seen a fight at a Grateful Dead show unless they were drinking, I think.
they're remarkably peaceful events considering the level of intoxication.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Brian. That was
thanks
fun.
A lot. Yeah, thanks a lot. I'll edit it together and I'll send you an email when it's up. This music isn't the Grateful Dead, it's Rising. The song is called Memories of Thailand. The Kratom Science Podcast is written and produced by me.